Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Enoch Powell, and because he is such a great Briton, this will actually be in four separate parts, the first of which will be broadcast today, and later in the year we will be broadcasting the consecutive parts of the series. And as always, my co-host for today's episode is Max Musson. We've got a particularly good Greatest Briton to talk about today. We're going to be talking about Enoch Powell, and I really don't remember Enoch Powell very much. I remember having an old employer who first told me about him and said that he was the best politician that we ever had. And he made a famous speech called the Rivers of Blood speech, and everybody in Britain supported this man. But the media and the politicians were against him. And if only. And when we look into his history, he wasn't just famous for this speech. He was another incredibly intelligent man that was well known for giving fantastic speeches. He's actually in the BBC's top 100 Greatest Britons as well. Max, I don't really know, I don't recall seeing him on television or anything like that, but you're a little bit older than me. I'm sure you remember Enoch Powell. What are your thoughts on Enoch Powell before we begin to discuss him here?
Well, Enoch Powell was a very intelligent man. You only had to hear him speak. And when he spoke, he didn't speak boringly. He spoke in sometimes very flowery language, but it was always language which described precisely the concept that he was trying to convey. And he obviously was somebody who had a tremendous education. Somebody who believed that the power of speech was very important, and you know, when you look back through his life, you see that he not only learned and became highly proficient, and I think he won a prize in the year that he took an exam on ancient Greek and Latin. He won the highest possible award for that particular exam. But he not only learned classical languages, he also learned Portuguese. He learned how to speak Urdu. He learned how to speak Russian. He learned so many languages. It's just amazing. And he was an amazing man. And it's just such a pity that when we see so many politicians nowadays who are who've got second-class intellects and who can't actually grasp the reality of the situation that this country is in. It's just such a pity that a man with such a towering intellect as Enoch Powell was sidelined by corrupt politicians during his era. So therefore, we didn't benefit from having him lead the country.
So he was an absolute champion wordsmith. Apparently, he was very good at uniting the classes as well. I mean, after he gave this speech, he had all the football supporters and all the working classes that were supporting him, as well as those in the upper class. And that's quite a unique talent, that is, being able to unite all the different factions in the country. This is why it was such a shame that he left politics. But we'll get into that later on. Let's start with a summary of his life here. John Enoch Powell, MBE, member of the British Empire, who was born in 1912 and died in 1998, was not just a British politician with a gift for eloquent speeches, but also a classical scholar, an author, a linguist, a soldier, a philologist, and a poet. Before entering politics, Powell was a classical scholar, becoming a full professor of ancient Greek at the age of 25 in Australia. During World War II, he served in both staff and intelligence positions, reaching the rank of brigadier in his early 30s. He was also a poet, with published works as early as 1937, as well as an author writing many books on classical and political subjects. He served as a Conservative Member of Parliament from 1950 to 1974, where he was Minister of Health between 60 and 63, and later was an MP for the Ulster Unionist Party from 1974 to 1987. Powell attracted widespread attention following his 20th of April 1968 address to the general meetings of the West Midlands Area Conservative Political Centre, which became known as the Rivers of Blood speech. It criticised the then much lower rate of immigration into the UK, especially from the new Commonwealth, and opposed the then proposed anti-discrimination legislation, the Race Relations Bill. In response, Conservative Party leader Edward Heath sacked Powell from his position as Shadow Defence Secretary in the Conservative opposition. The speech was immediately considered by the press as a blatant demonstration of racism and drew sharp criticism from his own party as a result. In the aftermath of the speech, several polls suggested that between 67 and 82% of the UK population agreed with Powell's opinions. And still today, he is remembered as one of the top 100 greatest Britons, according to a poll conducted by the BBC. His supporters claim that the large public following which Powell attracted helped the Conservatives to win the 1970 general election, and perhaps cost them the February 1974 general election, when Powell turned his back on them by endorsing a vote for Labour, which returned as a minority government in early March following a hung parliament. Powell was returned to the House of Commons in October 1974 as the Ulster Unionist Party MP for the Northern Ireland constituency of South Down, and he stayed representing the constituency until he was defeated at the 1987 general election. And Max, just before we actually went on air today, you were telling me something about Powell's greatest failure was that he didn't actually form a party of his own. Do you want to mention that a little bit here?
Well, this was in the sort of mid-70s when Enoch Powell eventually left the Conservative Party and took up and then got himself re-elected as a Member of Parliament for, I think it was one of the Ulster Unionist parties. But the point is that at that point, there was tremendous support for Enoch Powell. And as the text that you've just been reading from suggests, between 67 and 82% of the UK population agreed with Powell's opinion, which would tend to mean if you can that virtually 100% of the Conservative Party's rank and file members would have agreed with Enoch Powell, and it would have only been the Parliamentary Conservative Party and the small nucleus of people around Edward Heath that actually wanted Enoch Powell thrown out of the party. And so had Enoch Powell at that point announced that he was forming his own political party, then my belief is that his party would have almost immediately would have eclipsed the Conservative Party and he would have then become a future prime minister. And it's one of the greatest sadnesses of my life that he didn't do that. He just didn't have the courage or the self-belief to do that, which is a great shame. And this country is all worse off for that fact. But it's just amazing how different the country might have been had he been a more determined person.
He is known as the greatest prime minister that we never had. And one interesting point about this, I think, is, I mean, if they say that there was a poll and 82% of the UK population agreed with his opinions, why was the mainstream media completely against him? Why was his party completely against him? What does that tell us? It tells us that the mainstream media and the Conservative Party are completely against the population of Britain. They do not have the same goals as the population of Britain. I mean, it's just incredible to me that a man that was so popular, they would shoot down his opinions and pretend that he's the bad guy. And they've done that ever since. They still make him out to be a terrible person and a terrible racist. In actual fact, what they're doing is just condemning the population here. And since it's 82%, as you point out there, Max, it's going to have been all the Conservative Party members, but that means that it was a large amount of the Labour Party members as well. So if he had have formed a party, perhaps we would have had a credible third party and we wouldn't be in the situation that we are in today. It is a great shame that he didn't do that. Possibly it was through loyalty to the Conservatives, maybe old time loyalty. I mean, he'd been a member of the Conservative Party for quite some years by that time, and despite them stabbing him in the back like that, perhaps he still had loyalties to them. But it's a great shame. Great shame.
I think much of the 20th century saw a kind of internal, a civil war within the Conservative Party between what in perhaps in previous times would have been regarded as the Whigs in one faction and the Tories in the other faction. Nowadays, the term Tory is synonymous with Conservative, but the Tories were a faction within the Conservative Party for much of the 20th century, and they were the right wing of the Conservative Party. They were passionately royalist. They were passionately pro-parliament. They were patriotic, but they also had a sense of noblesse oblige, where they felt that it was the responsibility. It was kind of a patriarchal kind of concept, where they believed that people who were who formed the landed gentry and the aristocracy of the country had a duty to make to care for the needs of the working people. And there was, at the same time, simultaneously within the Labour Party, there were what I describe as patriotic working class people that would have supported Robert Blatchford, who was one of the founding fathers of the Labour Party and who eventually joined the Conservative Party and joined the Tory side of the Conservative Party. And there have been points during the 20th century when the Tory right of the Conservative Party has forged a connection with the patriotic left of the Labour Party. And I would say that the closest we've come to that in recent times has been the support there was for Nigel Farage in the referendum struggle, and also to a lesser degree that the situation that we've had in more recent times, where Boris Johnson has tended to represent the right wing of the Conservative Party, and yet he still had an appeal with the patriotic elements within the Labour Party, so that he was able then to win the red wall constituencies during the last general election, and so therefore getting himself elected with a thumping great majority. So there always has been this kind of connection, and it's just a pity, really, that the politicians who have benefited in those occasions haven't just gone that bit further and taken the steps to turn back all the things that are going wrong with this country. And this is where the Conservative Party, as people have said on so many occasions, have failed to actually conserve anything of any real value. And all they tend to do is to maintain the status quo and then win the more avaricious and money-focused elements within the Conservative Party, what would have been regarded as the Whigs in times gone by, where those people who tend to play to the tune of international capitalism and international finance, those sort of people have then sort of wrecked the country. And so it's just a great pity that we haven't had a leader that's been able to create a coalition of the patriotic right and the patriotic left and put the country right again.
Would you say then that the Whigs were the ones that were just trying to capitalise on whatever way things were going, and the Conservatives wanted to conserve things? Would that be a correct way to describe these Whigs?
Yeah, the Whigs would have been the merchant classes. They would have been the people who would have, during the 19th century, be regarded as, and the early 20th century, be regarded as the sort of nouveau riche. They were the people who were self-made men who'd made a lot of money out of banking, who'd made a lot of money out of international trade. And also that they were the people that made the most money out of the empire as well, actually, as it turns out. But they made that money. And then, of course, that they didn't want to then be prevented from exercising the power that their wealth gave them. They didn't want to be prevented from doing that by social convention. They didn't want to be prevented from doing that by the fact that the aristocracy and the monarchy in those days wanted to keep the nation strong and prioritise keeping the nation strong over facilitating the further enrichment of those merchant classes.
Well, so I mean, the way that seems to explain it to me is that today the majority of them are Whigs, but they're actually called Tories. I think so the only genuine Tory that there is today is probably Jacob Rees-Mogg, who does tend to have a sense of noblesse oblige. But unfortunately, it was his father in the Times that really went for Enoch Powell and slammed him with his newspaper, The Times. And we noticed that Jacob Rees-Mogg still does the same today, it's a great shame, really, that none of them will actually speak up for him. Because if some of them would, then I think they would gain a lot of the support that Enoch Powell actually had. And none of them had a backbone. None of them will actually speak up for him. They all say that he was, you know, the devil incarnate. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, if one of them would actually stand up and speak for him, then I would have thought it would be Jacob Rees-Mogg. But no, he travels in his father's footsteps, basically, and refuses to honour the man. Well, let's look at his early life then. John Enoch Powell was born in Stechford, Worcestershire, on the 16th of June 1912 to parents of Welsh descent. He lived there for the first 6 years of his life before his parents moved to King's Norton in 1918, where he lived until 1930. He was the only child of Albert Enoch Powell, a primary school headmaster, and his wife Ellen Mary, who was the daughter of Henry Breeze, a Liverpool policeman. His great-grandfather was a coal miner, and his grandfather had been employed in the iron trade. So he's got quite a working-class background there, a fairly intelligent father, was a headmaster, and his mother, the daughter of a policeman, so understood law and order. So really, working class, really, but with a higher-than-average IQ, I would say, that he was inherited from his father, primary school headmaster. Powell read avidly from a young age, and as early as three, he could read reasonably well, being nicknamed the Professor by his family because he used to stand on a chair and describe the stuffed birds his grandfather had shot, which were displayed in his parents' home. Though not wealthy, the Powell family were comparatively comfortable financially, always having enough money for books, and their home included a library. Powell was heavily influenced by the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, but it is not known how early he first came across him. He first went to King's Norton Grammar School for Boys before moving to King Edward's School, Birmingham, where he studied the classics and was one of few pupils in the school's history to attain 100% in an end-of-year English examination. He then studied at Trinity College, Cambridge from 1930 to 1933, during which time he fell under the influence of the poet A.E. Housman, then the professor of Latin at the university. He also began to study German at this time, as many of the most prominent classics scholars were German. Strangely, he took no part in politics at university. While studying at Cambridge, Powell became aware that there was another classicist who signed his name as John U. Powell, and deciding to distinguish the other man's work from his own, Powell decided to use his middle name instead of his first, and from that moment on always referred to himself as Enoch Powell. While at university, in one Greek prose examination lasting 3 hours, he was asked to translate a passage into Greek. Powell walked out after just 1.5 hours, having produced two translations, one in the style of Plato and the other in the style of Thucydides. For his efforts, he was awarded a double-starred first in Latin and Greek, this grade being the highest possible and extremely rare. As well as his education at Cambridge, Powell took a course in Urdu at the School of Oriental Studies because he felt his long-cherished ambition of becoming Viceroy of India would be unattainable without the knowledge of an Indian language. Other languages he learned included Welsh, in which he jointly edited a medieval legal text, modern Greek, and Portuguese. And later on we'll learn that he also learnt Russian. I mean, that's incredible, producing two translations, one in the style of Plato and the other in the style of Thucydides. I mean, that is incredible. And then walking out after just half the amount of time that he actually had to spend on that, and 100% in his end-of-year English examination. This is a very, very intelligent man specialising in language, who started out really, you know, just working class, basically. But he had this idea that he wanted to be Viceroy of India, and it must have been possible for him to actually get there, or he wouldn't have had a dream like that. I mean, this was the thing with the British Empire. You could work your way up from working class to upper class. Yes, it might rely upon meeting an aristocrat along the way. But as you were saying, Max, because these aristocrats, they had this noblesse oblige. They would feel obliged to help somebody that was very intelligent, and they would give them a leg up on the ladder, as it were. I was talking with Dr. Edward Dutton, Professor Edward Dutton, the other day, and he was saying, well, it was all about who you know rather than what you know, but the who you know, the who you came across would feel obliged to help somebody if they showed above average intelligence and would help them out with business contacts and all the rest of it. So it would have been possible for him to have become Viceroy of India if we hadn't lost India when we lost the British Empire. Max, you got any comments you want to make on his early life here?
Just to reiterate again the fact that he was a brilliant scholar, and also somebody who, unusual for somebody of his age, had a clear vision of what he wanted to do later in life. Because so many people nowadays, because there aren't the opportunities that used to exist in times gone by, many people reach university and drift through university and come out the other end and still have got no clear idea of what they want to do with their lives, because there just aren't the avenues that are really thrilling and motivational to inspire them. Also, I mean, as far as Powell was concerned, he was, during his early life, a great supporter of the British Empire. And obviously that's why he wanted to be Viceroy of India, which I think was regarded by most people as being the most colourful and eventful part of the British Empire in terms of the potential for the empire to go on to future greatness. It was, you know, the focal point of the empire, apart from, of course, Britain herself. Once Enoch Powell became aware of the fact that as a result of World War II, we had lost the wherewithal, we had lost the certainly the political will from most of the government at that point to actually hold on to the empire. That was the point where Powell's interest in the empire started to wane.
Yeah, it's a great tragedy that we lost that empire, and he was really cut up about it when it actually happened. But again, that's a little while into the future yet. In 1937, he was appointed Professor of Greek at the University of Sydney at age 25, failing in his aim of beating Nietzsche's record of becoming a professor at 24. And I don't know much about these grades, but I'm guessing that's a very young age to become a professor. I'm not even sure what qualifications you have to have to actually become a professor. Is it like studying for a degree, or is it something that is bestowed upon you, Max? Do you know?
I think you just need to be appointed as a professor by a university. Right. That's really what it amounts to. You leave university as a graduate. You can do postgraduate studies, which I believe that Powell did. And I think he was a fellow of the college that he went to in Cambridge. But I think it's then just really a matter of somebody regarding your postgraduate studies as being such that it justifies you being appointed a professor so that you can share your knowledge with new students.
Oh, amazing. That's quite a credit to him to have become a professor at 24. Soon after arrival in Australia, he was appointed curator of the Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney, where he stunned the vice chancellor by informing him that war would soon begin in Europe and that when it did, he would be heading home to enlist in the army. By the time Powell had left King Edward's School in 1930, he had confirmed his instinctive belief that peace was merely temporary and that the UK would soon be at war with Germany again. So he had that idea all the way back in 1930. He was not happy with Prime Minister Chamberlain averting war with Hitler, as he saw it as a betrayal of the national interests. And after Chamberlain's first visit to Adolf Hitler at the Berchtesgaden, he would write in a letter to his parents on the 18th of September 1938, "I do here in the most solemn and bitter manner curse the Prime Minister of England for having accumulated all his other betrayals of the national interest and honour by his last terrible exhibition of dishonour, weakness and gullibility. The depths of infamy to which our accursed love of peace can lower us are unfathomable." In another letter to his parents in June 1939, before the beginning of war, Powell wrote, "It is the English, not their government, for if they were not blind cowards, they would lynch Chamberlain and Halifax and all the other smarmy traitors. At the outbreak of war, Powell immediately returned to the UK, but not before buying a Russian dictionary, since he thought Russia would hold the key to our survival and victory, as it had in 1812 and 1916. So he certainly seems ahead of the curve here in both points, understanding that there was going to be another war with Germany. Of course, that was set up by the Versailles Peace Treaty, and the terms of that pretty much guaranteed there was going to be another war. And here he understood that it was going to rest on what happened with Russia. And I do find it a little bit of poetic justice that he's obviously got an anti-Hitler mentality, and he would have got that from the mainstream media. And he obviously believed the mainstream media, as most people did back then. And when it came to his time in the limelight, in the glare of the mainstream media, they cursed him. And he saw, and he got the back end of it. So there was a bit of justice there. Is there anything on that you want to pick out and comment on, Max?
I was just sort of agreeing with the irony of that situation, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I guess that's the word, isn't it? Irony. Well, I think we've got enough time to get into a little bit of his military service, the start of his military service here. During October 1939, almost a month after returning home from Australia, Powell enlisted in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. Rather than waiting to be called up, he had claimed to be Australian. As Australians, many of whom had travelled to Britain at great expense to join up, were allowed to enlist straight away. In a poem, he wrote of men joining the army like bridegrooms going to meet their brides. But his biographer points out that it is unlikely that many other men shared his joy, particularly not those who were actually leaving actual brides behind. Powell was commissioned on the general list in 1940 after answering the question of an inspecting brigadier with a Greek proverb, but almost immediately transferred to the intelligence corps. He was soon promoted to captain and posted as GS-03 Intelligence to the 1st and later the 9th Armoured Division. During this time, he taught himself the Portuguese language in order to read the poet Camões in the original language. As insufficient Russian-speaking officers were available at the War Office, his knowledge of the Russian language and textual analysis skills were used to translate a Russian parachute training manual, a task he completed after 11 p.m. in addition to his normal duties, deducing the meaning of many technical terms from the context. On one occasion during this time, he was arrested as a suspected German spy for singing the Horst Wessel lead and was sent to the Staff College, Camberley. So I think what we can take from this is, I mean, this is an incredibly intelligent man, and yet he's still desperate to join up with the army and to give his life for his country. So he's incredibly patriotic, and that gives us an idea of the mentality of most of the people back then. Imagine flying back from Australia just so that you could join up with the army because you're so desperate to join, and lying about your citizenship and saying you are Australian just so that you can actually join the army and give your life for your country. I mean, I doubt whether there's anybody in Britain today that would be like that, that would be so desperate to give their lives for their country. And yet that was the love that people had back then for their nation, for their country, and for their king. Is there anything you want to pick out on this bit, Max, and comment on?
Just that I think that lots of young men during that period would have looked back in over what to them would have been quite recent history, the latter part of the 19th century. They would have seen the opportunities that existed through the forging of the British Empire. And so therefore, for a young man, it probably would have been, there would have been sort of romantic associations between sort of combining proving your worth as a man and also being of service to your country and risking your life in order to make your own fortune and in order to make your own nation and the empire to which you belong stronger. In that respect, Enoch Powell would have been very similar to what Enoch Powell sort of says, or what's written about him here, is reminiscent, really, of the kind of things that that Hitler kind of said to himself during the sort of early post First World War period, where he wished to become German and wished to join the German army so that he could again help to expand the German Empire and make his fortune that way as well. So I suspect that lots of young men had similar kind of romantic notions without necessarily thinking too seriously about the grimmer side of warfare. I know that as far as my own father was concerned, you know, he and all his brothers all went and enlisted on the first occasion they could to go and fight during the Second World War. And so I imagine that Enoch Powell was filled with the same kind of patriotic fever.
And also, when we talked about the British Empire before and the characters from the British Empire, a lot of it has been battles and wars. And there probably hadn't been that many going on since the First World War. And everything that they would have read about the British Empire would have included all these battles and wars. So it would have been idealized, I guess. So they would have wanted to do the same as their ancestors did and wanted to show the world what they were made of. Well, should we get into our greatest Britons then, Max? Enoch Powell?
Yes. Okay. Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into Enoch Powell. We'll begin with a recap of what we talked about last week. Enoch Powell was a classical scholar, becoming a full professor of ancient Greek at the age of 25 in Australia, although he was first called the professor by his family at the age of 3. He passed 2 notable examinations with the highest grades possible, 100% in an end-of-year English examination at a grammar school, and during one Greek prose examination at university, when asked to translate a passage into Greek, he walked out halfway through after producing 2 translations, one in the style of Plato and the other in Thucydides. For this, he was awarded a double-starred first in Latin and Greek, the highest grade possible and hardly ever achieved by anyone. He foresaw that there would be war with Germany in the early 30s and returned from Australia to sign up in 1939, where he was quickly put on the general list after showing how well educated he was in ancient Greek. Shortly after, he was promoted to captain, where he then found a home in the intelligence corps. I'm not quite sure what the relevance of ancient Greek actually had to being put on the general list, but that takes us up to where we got to last week. Max, is there anything else you want to add to that? Any thoughts you have about that?
I would just think that the relevance of ancient Greek would just be the versatility of his ability to converse in different languages or to understand different languages, because they, when you learn one language, there are very often words that are shared with other languages. And so by learning ancient Greek, there would obviously be a link between ancient Greek and modern Greek, but there would also be links between ancient Greek and Latin. And there would be links from Latin and ancient Greek or modern Greek with the languages of the countries surrounding him. So it would put him, because he did know, I think there's something about 6 languages he was fluent in. And through doing that, it would mean that although he wouldn't necessarily be fluent in other languages that are associated, he would at least be able to understand the basic gist of anybody's argument in those languages. And so it would make him a very useful person, particularly in the intelligence corps.
Yeah, really, really good. Yeah, really good answer there, Max. Very well thought out. He'd certainly have been a lot of use to them. And he was actually in these translations as well. Well, in October 1941, Powell was posted to Cairo and transferred back to the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. As secretary to the Joint Intelligence Committee, Middle East, he was soon doing work that would normally have been carried out by a more senior officer and was promoted to major, with it being backdated to May. He was then promoted to lieutenant colonel in August 1942, telling his parents that he was doing the work of 3 people at once, and he expected to be a brigadier within a year or two. Powell and his team began work at 0400 hours each day, digesting radio intercepts and other intelligence data, such as estimating how many tanks Rommel currently had and what his likely plans were, so that they were then ready to present to the chiefs of staff at 0900 hours. It was in Algiers that the beginning of Powell's distrust of the United States began. After mixing socially with senior American officers and exploring their cultural views of the world, he became convinced that one of America's war aims was to destroy the British Empire. Writing home on the 16th of February 1943, Powell stated, "I see growing on the horizon the greater peril than Germany or Japan ever were, our terrible enemy, America." His suspicion of the anti-British Empire demeanor of the US government's foreign policy would continue for the remainder of the war and into his subsequent post-war political career. He cut out and retained an article from the New Statesman magazine published on 13th of November 1943, in which the American writer and diplomat Clare Booth Lucy said in a speech that Indian independence from the British Empire would mean that the USA will really have won the greatest war in the world for democracy. Now, what I get from that is I'm thinking, well, he's suspicious of America here, but I think really he should have been suspicious of these bankers that were engineering all of this, that were engineering the war, and that are still making all their money out of India, and yet they have direct control now instead of having to go through Britain. I think the empire is still there, but it's a banker's empire. And it's much more nakedly a banker's empire than it is now. And I think his suspicion of America should really have been suspicion of the bankers. But it is good that he did have this suspicion. He knew something wasn't right, but he was blaming the Americans for it. What do you think I'm right in thinking that, Max?
I think that as far as Powell is concerned, he shared the view of Winston Churchill during this particular period, because there was a meeting which I think was one of the major wartime meetings between the leaders of the Allies, where Churchill turned around to Roosevelt and said, "Sir, I do believe," or words to the effect of, "Sir, I do believe your aim is the abolition of the British Empire." It seems that Powell wasn't alone in coming to that conclusion. And I think that from the point of view of the USA, in view of the fact that they had that they've got their own national outlook, that if their involvement in World War II benefited them as a nation and meant that they came out stronger and meant that they came out as the strongest nation in the world and the most influential nation, then that obviously would be something that they would value and look forward to. And so that was only to be expected, in my view.
Well, it was actually Winston Churchill that ended up destroying the British Empire. So he was suspicious of America that they might have wanted that, and it was actually Churchill himself that did that with his senseless, brutal war against a brother nation of Germany for the bankers, basically. After the Axis defeat at the Second Battle of El Alamein, Powell's attention increasingly moved to the Far East Theater, where he wanted to take part in the campaign against the Japanese Imperial Army. This was because, quote, the war in Europe was now won, close quote. And he wanted to see the Union flag flying back in Singapore before the Americans beat the Empire to it and secured an imperial domination of their own over the region. He had at this time an ambition to be assigned to the Chindits units operating in Burma and secured an interview with their commander Ord Wingate, hoping to achieve this while the latter was on a temporary stopover in Cairo. But Powell's duties and rank prevented him. Having declined two posts, carrying the rank of full colonel in Algiers and Cairo, which would have left him in the now moribund North African theatre indefinitely, and despite expecting to accept a reduction in rank to major in order to get the transfer, he secured a posting to the British Imperial Indian Army in Delhi as a lieutenant colonel for military intelligence in August 1943. Within a few days of arriving in the country, Powell bought as many books as he could about the country and read them avidly. On one occasion, he would write to his parents in a letter, "I soaked up India like a sponge soaks up water." And we should remember here that he was hoping to eventually be the chap that actually leads India. That was his big ambition. He was appointed secretary to the Joint Intelligence Committee for India and Louis Mountbatten's Southeast Asia Command, which involved planning an amphibious offensive against Akyab, an island off the coast of Burma. Ord Wingate, who was also involved in planning this operation, unfortunately took such a dislike to Powell that he asked a colleague to restrain him if he was tempted to beat his brains in. And remember, this is the same Ord Wingate that Enoch Powell had been hoping to meet because he wanted to serve under him. And I wonder whether this Ord Wingate didn't deliberately avoid actually having that interview with him, because maybe, you know, he just had a dislike for him somehow. On one occasion, Powell's yellow skin, which was caused by jaundice, and he was recovering from that at the time, his overformal dress and his strange manner caused him to be mistaken for a Japanese spy. I remember he was also mistaken for a German spy last week for singing the Horst Wessel lead. He was so busy during this period that he declined to meet a Cambridge academic colleague, Glyn Daniel, for a drink or dinner, as he was devoting his limited leisure time to studying the poet John Donne. He also continued to learn Urdu, consistent with his ambition of becoming Viceroy of India. And when Mountbatten transferred his staff to Kandy, Ceylon, Powell chose to remain in Delhi. He was promoted to full colonel at the end of March 1944 as the Assistant Director of Military Intelligence in India, giving intelligence support to the Burma campaign of William Slim. So he's really working his way up. So he's now the Assistant Director of all the military intelligence in India. He's not just serving under one specific group. He's right over the top of them, and he's not spending a lot of time in recuperating or in recreation. He would much prefer to actually continue studying rather than actually meeting up with his old friends. But he still hasn't actually seen any physical action, which I think he wasn't very happy about, really. Any thoughts on that, Max, and his time that he spent in India?
Well, just that the friction between him and Ord Wingate would probably just be normal rivalry that occurs between characters. If you are in a managerial position, which being an officer in the British Army effectively puts you in, if you're in a managerial situation, then there are going to be other people are going to be coming up alongside you in the organisation, and that will be rubbing elbows with, and that you will to some extent be in competition with. And what we don't have to remember is that men don't suddenly lose their own personal ambition because they're serving in a war, and so therefore, a lot of people who became officers in the army during the war would have been quite excited by the idea that the war would mean that there would be a rate of attrition that would mean that there would be vacancies that would become available above them in the organisation that they could move up to fulfil. And they would also be aware of the fact that as the war expanded around the world, so the army would expand, new units would be created, and that that those units would then have further management vacancies that they could move into, whatever, you know, the rank concerned happened to be. And this sort of thing, you know, is bound to happen, and I'm sure did happen to some extent. And I would think that Ord Wingate probably had surrounded himself with people who perhaps deferred to him. Along comes Powell, who is intellectually brilliant and coming up with lots of new ideas, and obviously able to absorb information at a prolific rate. And he probably felt to some extent challenged by that, and regarded Powell as perhaps an up and coming potential rival for the future. And in the same way that Powell probably regarded other people that he had to work alongside in a similar kind of way. And so, you know, this is all to be expected, really.
I'm wondering where I've heard the name Ord Wingate before. Is that a common name? Have you heard of him before, Max?
Yeah, so Ord Wingate was the commander of the British Army that worked in the Chindits division. The Chindits were the natives of Southeast Asia, and there were a number of tribes amongst them who allied themselves with Britain, and there were also a number of native tribes that allied themselves with the Japanese. And but Ord Wingate became famous for leading the Chindits in a number of daring campaigns in Southeast Asia that helped significantly in the battle against the Japanese.
So similar to elsewhere in the British Empire, where they made use of of the natives, like General Gordon when he had that Imperial Chinese army that he was leading. And I guess this is where we got our interest from Burma from as well. We're still involved in intrigues in Burma to this day, trying to force the Burmese to go along with democratic ideals. Well, having begun the war as the youngest professor in the Commonwealth, Powell ended it as a brigadier, exactly like he had predicted he would. And for a few weeks, he was actually the youngest brigadier in the entire British Army, and he was one of only two men in the entire war to rise from private to brigadier, the other being Fitzroy Maclean. Powell was given the promotion so that he could serve on a committee of generals and brigadiers to plan the post-war defence of India, and the resulting 470-page report was almost entirely written by him. After this, he was offered a regular commission as a brigadier in the Indian Army, with the post of assistant commandant at an Indian officers' training academy, but he declined, telling a colleague that he expected to be head of all military intelligence in the next war. Powell never really experienced combat and felt guilty for having survived, writing that soldiers who did so carried a sort of shame with them to the grave. And he also referred to the Second Battle of El Alamein as a separating flame between the living and the dead. When once asked how he would like to be remembered, he first answered, "Others will remember me as they will remember me." But when later pressed, he replied, "I should like to have been killed in the war." So he obviously felt a sense of shame at this, and maybe a sense of guilt. And they talk about that, don't they? Survivor guilt, when others have died and you actually survived in things like this in the war. And also, I mean, he's not wanting to lead the Indians. He's not wanting to stay at the officers' training academy, and thinks that there's going to be another war. I mean, thankfully there wasn't another war, but I guess he was probably thinking, well, it wasn't that long since the last one, 1918, so perhaps there's going to be another one. I mean he must have been really unaware of quite what was happening, and the way that this United Nations thing was taking shape, which is basically just rule by the bankers and the EU. And I guess where he was involved, you know, hands-on in the war, even though he wasn't involved in physical battle, but where he was concentrating on all of that, I guess he wasn't paying too much attention to the global intrigue at this time. And he never could have had a dream of what was going to happen after the war with the immigration, I guess. Max, you got any thoughts on this?
I was just going to say that him expressing that wish to be the head of all military intelligence in the next war kind of suggests that he found his involvement in the war exciting, that he viewed it as something as a vehicle for him to advance himself socially and career-wise within the army, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because ambition makes people strive to be better, and so I'm not criticizing necessarily for that, but the fact that I think it also betrays though the fact that he didn't realize the significance at the time of the Second World War, and the fact that the Second World War would not only bring about this this transfer of primacy as a world power from the British Empire to the United States of America, but it will also bring about a defeat of those nations that were fighting for the future prosperity, etc., of the white nations of the world, and didn't realise the mistaken role that we were playing in fighting against those nations.
I don't think
the impact it would have through mass immigration on us in later years, yes.
Well, he didn't really understand, I don't think, that the nations we were fighting against were nationalist nations that had a patriotism, which is now completely gone and has been gone since the end of the Second World War. And he certainly had a lot of confidence in his own abilities, didn't he? Thinking that he was going to be the head of all military intelligence, or the viceroy of India. I wonder if there's Well, it doesn't really seem like there was any arrogance in that, because, I mean, to get those top marks in those exams and to rise through the army like that, and it doesn't say here that it was through anybody that he knew, it was all through his own achievement and through his own hard work. So perhaps there wasn't any arrogance there. He was just he just had a correct appraisal of his own abilities and saw that and knew what it was that he wanted to do. He then returned to England, where his ambition to become Viceroy of India would be crushed in February 1947, when Prime Minister Clement Attlee announced that Indian independence was imminent. Powell was so shocked by this change of policy that he spent the whole night after it was announced walking the streets of London. He would come to terms with the news by becoming fiercely anti-imperialist, believing that now that India had gone, the rest of the empire should follow. This logical absolutism explained his later indifference to the Suez Crisis, his contempt for the Commonwealth, and his urging that the UK should end any remaining pretense that it was a world power. He joined the Conservative Party and was then elected as a Conservative Member of Parliament for Wolverhampton South West in the 1950 general election. And that was the start of his career as a politician. But this bit here, you know, he's lost the British Empire. That was it. That was the crown. Well, the jewel in the crown, wasn't it? Was India, and this Indian independence. It had been, you know, this desire for India to be independent had been rising for a long time. And the British Empire had always said, we're trying to civilize these peoples until they get to a certain standard of civilization where they can actually govern themselves. And I don't know that the members of the British Empire, how seriously they actually took that, because that is pretty much what then happened. And we lost all of the British Empire. We just couldn't hold it together. And obviously Winston Churchill had been blamed for this, for the war and the cost of the war. And I guess most of it came down to economics. And we just couldn't afford to pay back what we had spent during the war at the same time as continue governing these countries. Would you agree with that, Max?
Well, I think Britain's position as a world power was predicated on us having the empire, and what Powell saw was that if we were prepared to give up what was regarded as the jewel of the British Empire, then what it signalled was a lack of political will within the government for Britain to continue to strive to be a world power. And if we weren't going to be a world power, then it was pointless us pretending to be such by clinging on to the little bits of the empire that remained. And I suppose from his point of view, he perhaps viewed that as being a point where the vehicle through which he saw his own personal advancement, he saw that vehicle had suddenly broken down effectively, and that it was not only broken down, but because of the breakdown, that vehicle would continue to diminish over time. And so him pacing the streets of London was him effectively grieving for the career that he thought was ahead of him, and desperately searching for the second career that was going to take its place, and one that would be perhaps fittingly serious to take the place of his previous career ambitions. But I think it also, you know, that is also reflected in the change of attitude on the part of the British government. As I say, if we wished as a country to continue to be a world power, then we needed to have influence, direct influence over a larger part of the Earth's surface, and so therefore we needed to retain those countries that formed part of the empire, and if we were going to continue to be a world power, we would have to continue to hold India, and it was critical that we continue to hold India. And the fact that we decided not to, the fact that we decided to give India up, was an indication of the loss of that ambition as a nation to become and to remain the leading world power, and that is the equivalent of Howell's personal ambition writ large.
It must have been devastating for the British people as well. You know, you think they've just spent years fighting this long war against Germany, and what do they have at the end of it? They've lost the empire that took centuries to build, and that position on the world stage. I mean, so much was centered around the empire. People would have ideas, like Powell did, of where they were going to go within the empire and what they were going to do. And even schooling and education was all based around this as well. And it was all lost in that war. I don't think we still haven't got over it as a nation. You know, I mean, just the state of shock. Him spending the night walking through the streets of London. I mean, you can imagine that affecting the whole nation as well. An absolute state of shock at the end of the war, 2 years after the war, to discover that we've lost the empire. And yeah, and then he takes a change of course and decides that he's going to become a politician in the Conservative Party. And on the 3rd of March 1953, Powell spoke against the Royal Titles Bill in the House of Commons, where he said he found three major changes to the style of the United Kingdom, all of which seemed to me to be evil. The first was that in this title, for the first time, will be recognised a principle hitherto never admitted in this country, namely, the divisibility of the crown. He went on to say that the unity of the realm had evolved over centuries, and that it included the British Empire. It was a unit because it had one sovereign. There was one sovereign and one realm. He feared that by recognizing the division of the realm into separate realms, we are not opening the way for that other remaining unity, the last unity of all, that of the person, to go the way of the rest. The second change he objected to was the suppression of the word British from before the words realms and territories, where it was replaced by the words her other, and from before the word Commonwealth, which in the Statute of Westminster is described as the British Commonwealth of Nations. And we have a long quote here. To say that he is monarch of a certain territory and his other realms and territories is as good as to say that he is king of his own kingdom. We have perpetrated a solecism in the title we are proposing to attach to our sovereign, and we have done so out of what might almost be called an abject desire to eliminate the expression British. The same desire has been felt to eliminate this word before the term Commonwealth. Why is it then that we are so anxious in the description of our own monarch in a title for use in this country to eliminate any reference to the seat, the focus, and the origin of this vast aggregate of territories? Why is it that this teeming womb of royal kings, as Shakespeare called it, wishes now to be anonymous? Powell claimed that the answer was because the British Nationality Act of 1948 had removed allegiance to the Crown as the basis for citizenship and replaced it with nine separate citizenships combined together by statute. Therefore, if any of these nine countries became republics, the law would not change, as had happened with India when it became a republic. Furthermore, Powell went on, the essence of unity was that all the parts recognised they would sacrifice themselves to the interests of the whole. He denied that in India they had a recognition of belonging to a greater whole, which involves the ultimate consequence, in certain circumstances, of self-sacrifice in the interests of the whole. Therefore, the title Head of the Commonwealth, the third major change, was essentially a sham, something which we have invented to blind ourselves to the reality of the position. These changes were all greatly repugnant to Powell. And then we have another large quote here. If there are changes which are demanded by those who in many wars had fought with this country, by nations who maintained an allegiance to the crown, and who signified a desire to be in the future as were in the past, if it were our friends who had come to us and said, we want this, I would say, let it go. Let us admit the divisibility of the crown. Let us sink into anonymity and cancel the word British from our titles. If they like the conundrum head of the Commonwealth in the royal style, let it be there. However, the underlying evil of this is that we are doing it for the sake not of our friends, but of those who are not our friends. We are doing this for the sake of those to whom the very names Britain and British are repugnant. We are doing this for the sake of those who have deliberately cast off their allegiance to our common monarchy. And for the rest of his life, Powell regarded this speech as the finest that he had ever delivered, even more so than the more famous 1968 anti-immigration speech, and after making it, he went on to join the 1922 committee. So I think what we have here is he's very concerned that India no longer sees itself as part of the whole and would not sacrifice itself on the battlefields for Britain. And that's the reason for this. And he's obviously most concerned that the word Britain and British is being dropped from these very important titles. And he obviously has allegiance to the monarchy, but this is what the result of the war was. It was the end of patriotic Britain. It was the end of the idea of Britain being for the British. And with this Commonwealth and giving them all citizenships, they could all come into Britain basically and swamp Britain. And I don't think he realised that at this time, what the end result of that was going to be. But you can see here that he is very patriotic and he's not happy about the way that Britain is going. And he's also realised that he has this fantastic talent for giving speeches. I mean, this is a very famous speech. It's such a shame that the 1968 speech wasn't actually properly recorded. But this one was. You can find this one on YouTube and it is a very, very good speech. Max, what are your thoughts on what happened here and Enoch Powell's speech?
I think like the earlier passage we were talking about, it very much reflects the fact that within the British people at large, there was no realization at the start of the war what the effect of us fighting the war on the side that we chose to fight would have. And this is really because the realities of international power politics weren't widely understood, and they needed to be, not just international power politics, but even power politics within a nation and the dynamics of power politics within a nation. Powell was still too much at this point during the Second World War, still too much thinking of the war as being a vehicle for his own personal ambition, and also a vehicle for the ambitions he had for Britain as a nation. And that's why he was so gutted when he realized that we were going to be giving up the empire, and therefore that would mean that we were relinquishing any possibility of us continuing as the preeminent world power at that point in time. The kind of speech he's got, he's made with the references to there being the need to be one realm, one monarch, etc. These are reminiscent of the three exhortations that were most popular within the Third Reich. Ironically, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, interpreted as one people, one realm, one monarch. And it's fairly clear from what Enoch Powell was saying there that he actually believed in the integrity of those three exhortations. It's just very ironic that both he and the British people at large during that period didn't make that same realization.
He's starting to realize, he's had the wool pulled over his eyes, hasn't he? He's starting to realize that Germany weren't the enemy. There was other enemies which are now making the threat to us clear. And as you say, if these people have been our friends that wanted this independence, then yeah, we would give it to them. But they're not. It's our enemies. It's these other forces. We thought we were going against our enemy in the Second World War, but in actual fact, we weren't, because the enemy is still there and it's now pulling apart the whole of the British Empire. And as you very eloquently pointed out there, Max, I mean, what he was actually pointing to was the same thing as the Third Reich was. We weren't that different from them. And it's a shame that more people didn't speak German and actually take the time to listen to what Adolf Hitler was actually talking about, I think. Well, we should probably leave that there for today, Max. I think, have you got anything else you want to add to it?
I was just going to say that had we not declared war on Germany in 1939, then we could have maintained the British Empire and we still would have been one of the preeminent world powers after the Second World War. What would have happened, though, is that Germany would have expanded eastwards, which is what Hitler had always said he wanted to do. And he would have created an empire for Germany extending into Russia and through Russia into Central Asia. Nazi Germany would have taken the place of Soviet Russia as being the world power that occupied that land. And so that instead of it being the United States, Russia, or you know, the Soviet Union, as it actually was, instead of it being the United States, the Soviet Union, and the British Empire being the three preeminent world powers at the end of the Second World War, it would have been the United States, Nazi Germany, and the British Empire, and there would have been a closer cultural link, I think, between a German Empire as opposed to a Russian Empire, and the difference would have been, though, that instead of us being a weakened Britain diminishing as a world power, whereas the Soviet Union were a progressively strengthening world power that's eventually eclipsed us as a world power, and instead of the United States being a steadily strengthening power that's eclipsed us as a world power, so that we've been squeezed out of the top two, it would have been a situation where we would have been able to maintain preeminence, I think, and or at least equal standing with the USA and Germany, as opposed to the Soviet Union.
And 100 million Russians wouldn't have died, 100 million Christian Russians, and also, the Soviet Union was pretty backward at that time, Russia was pretty backward, and that was Hitler's plan, wasn't it? It was to develop it and bring it forward so it was as advanced as Germany, the sort of plans that they had for Norway. So Russia would have been like Norway and Sweden instead of being like Russia is today. And we'll leave that there for today. I think if you want to hear more from Greatest Britons, it features as a part of the Real Britannia podcast, which we normally have on Mondays at Radio Albion. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out later in the year for the next part of our Greatest Britain series on Enoch Powell.